I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books in political theory and social and political philosophy. Today, I'm talking to Wendy Brown, class of 1936, first chair in political science and philosophy at the University of California, Berkeley. We're discussing her 2019 book, In the Ruins of Neoliberalism, The Rise of Anti-Democratic Politics in the West, from Columbia University Press. Brown works on the history of political theory, 19th and 20th century continental theory, critical theory, and theories of contemporary capitalism. She is the author of 8 books, including Undoing the Demos, Neoliberalism's Stealth Revolution, and Walled States, Waning Sovereignty, as well as many, many articles. So let me say, first of all, Wendy Brown, thank you so much for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Wendy, I loved reading the book. It was a very spirited and penetrating look at contemporary neoliberalism and its effect on the crisis that we see today, the rise of anti-politics. So, and it's a sort of, I had on William Galston several weeks ago. I think this makes a nice sort of complement in two very different accounts of where we are today. Let me start by asking you, first of all, about the motivation for the book. And I usually just ask it straight away, just what is the motivation for your book? But in some ways, it's somewhat evident in the subtitle of the book and in your preface. You talk about writing the book in the wake of Trump and Brexit. But maybe I'll just put the question in this way, which is that, as I mentioned, Bill Galston's book, but several other books have been written recently in the wake of Trump that tries to sort of approach contemporary crisis of liberal democracy, but take it as a kind of that the contemporary crisis is a challenge to liberalism. And so I'm thinking of people like Michael Sandel or Yasha Mung, and they think that democracy is overwhelming liberalism, that you see a form of illiberal democracy. But if I have your book right, that you're arguing that liberalism is overwhelming democracy in some sense. So maybe you could say a little bit about what motivated you in this particular direction in contrast to some of the other accounts that are out there.
Let me start with your larger question, which is what motivated the book in general. I had written an earlier work on neoliberalism and democracy called Undoing the Demos. And that 2015 volume was concerned with what I argued was the slow but steady erosion of democratic principles, practices, and imaginaries by neoliberal rationality, a rationality that I take to be not just about economic policies, policies of deregulation, of trimming or eliminating the social state, of eliminating progressive taxation, of marketization of everything. Those are the economic policies. But also what Foucault has taught us to understand about neoliberalism, namely that it's a form of governing reason that extends beyond those economic policies to have a particular notion of the social, the subject, state, and to do what he calls a radical reprogramming of liberalism. And without going into detail about that book, what I was focused on there was the ways in which neoliberal governing rationality emerging in the Euro-Atlantic world really as early as the 70s, coming boldly into form with the Reagan-Thatcher revolutions and taking hold across the political spectrum as our new normal. And what I was concerned with was the extent to which we tended to focus on, if there's a we that is concerned with neoliberalism and democracy, we tended to focus on very explicit moments of attacks on the poor or removals of the social safety net and so forth, without looking at the way in which it was actually transforming understandings of democracy itself, largely by reducing them to narrow understandings of rights and elections, but also by assaulting some of the basic principles of democratic life in law, in politics, and in everyday practices, but above all, in citizen understandings of what democracy is and is for. So that was that book. And my argument there was that there was a kind of slow but steady erosion of robust notions of democracy by neoliberalism that made it increasingly difficult for us to even imagine democratic reforms that would be at the heart of what many consider to be growing inequality, growing disenfranchisement, and so forth, because democracy itself was in such a beleaguered state in our minds, in our institutions, and in our laws. Now, when the political earthquake of 2016 happened, the election of Trump, but also around the same time, the emergence of hard right parties in Europe that were beginning to increasingly succeed in proportional elections across Europe. The emergence of Bolsonaro, it's more recent, but Erdogan in Turkey, the authoritarian turn in much of Eastern Europe, especially Hungary. When all of that happened, it seemed to me that I had explained something about the erosion of democratic institutions, but I hadn't explained very much at all about how this could generate something of an anti-democratic, authoritarian, ethno-nationalist right. And that's what we're now in the midst of. And I kept being asked to comment on these elections and these events by newspapers and by especially European venues, but some in the United States and Latin America as well. And I kept being asked to comment in terms of my arguments in Undoing the Demos, where my argument was really, you know, what we're seeing is the economization of everyday life, including the economization of democracy. But I didn't have much to say about authoritarianism, populism, anti-democracy. So I was ashamed that I had gotten one part of the world under theoretical control, as it were, but I hadn't really seen, anticipated, or had much to say from the theoretical argument that I had made about our present. So that's what pushed me to the second work. It also pushed me back to some of the neoliberal intellectuals, especially the Austrian school, Hayek, to some degree the Chicago school, led obviously by Friedman, but comprising others as well. And lesser known to Americans, but very important in the European Union, the ordo-liberal school, or the Freiburg school. And in going back to the arguments of these thinkers, one of the things that jumped at me that I had not seen before was the extent to which they were interested in a program coming out of the crisis of both World War I and World War II, in which not merely markets, but traditional morality and the authority and the hierarchy in traditional morals would come to usurp the place of the social state, social justice, and robust democracy. And that was what really became the heart of this new book, the argument that we're not simply seeing marketization and its devastating effects producing an increasingly resentful and rancorous white working class that is no longer getting the benefits of a redistributive state, robust labor unions, all the other things that certainly neoliberalism tore apart. But more than that, there was also at the heart of the neoliberal project an attack on social justice, an attack on robust democracy, an attack on popular sovereignty, an attack on the idea that anything other than markets and morals ought to organize society, where morals had a very specific meaning, namely the traditional morality, as Hayek puts it, in which family, property, and to a large degree, religion would secure the bonds of society that should not be secured by social justice, a public good, public interest, or democratic practices, the kind you find in Tocqueville. Now, to conclude this, to your question about why I think democracy rather than liberalism is what's at stake, it should now be obvious. Liberalism has been transformed by neoliberalism. It's become increasingly identified on the one hand with the market and on the other hand with the liberty or the unconstrained right of traditional morality to have its way in the social and the public sphere. It has been transformed, but I don't think liberalism is what's at stake or what is challenged by the current eruptions of the right, for the most part, despite the way that some figures, like Orban in Hungary, are naming their project as an anti-liberal. Rights and liberties are largely being protected for and by citizens, or that is, by the state for citizens. But the demolition of the notion of social justice, the attack on the very idea of society as something that ought to feature equality, inclusion, and justice, those sorts of things have certainly been peeled out of liberalism. And more importantly, the idea that there ought to be collective democratic self-determination of how society is governed and who we are as a people and what we ought to be in the present and in the future, that's certainly been under attack. The idea of democratic inclusion is certainly under attack. So I don't think that the proper naming of our problem is the endangerment or the assault on liberalism. I think it's the assault on democracy. Liberal democracy, yes, but democracy too poor.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, your book's, I think, quite unique in this way, and that most commentators, I think, see the contemporary crisis, as it were, as a break with the past, some kind of overturning or reshuffling of different categories, a reaction against the excesses of the elite, whereas you see it as an unfolding of a process, as it were, it's sort of internal to neoliberalism itself.
Let's not go too far here. I'm not saying this is the realization of the neoliberal dream. Far from it.
Right.
I'm saying that the neoliberal revolution of the 70s and the 80s set into motion some valorizations and some denigrations, some valorizations of individual liberty, traditional morality, the valorization of the family, of ownership, and of belonging in place of social justice, inclusion, all of the other things that were challenging that and part of the social state. And I am also saying in the book that the original vision of the neoliberals has gone horribly awry. This was not the condition they wanted. They were trying to tap down mass political affect. They were trying to eliminate the plutocratic dimensions that are inevitable in markets. They were trying to produce states that would subtend a globally competitive order, not orders that would be controlled by oligarchs and plutocrats. They were trying to turn the state specifically in the direction of facilitating a competitive capitalist order, not one that was simply facilitating agglomerations and concentrations of wealth in certain corners. So it's a mistake to identify neoliberal dreams with the world that we have today, either the political eruptions in it or the particular economic dimensions in it. And of course, neoliberals had no plans for the financialization of markets and more generally the financialization of capitalism that produced 2008 and that have also produced such radical disruptions and dangers and perils politically as well as economically in the global order. So part of my argument is also that what was set in motion as a particular kind of response to the social state and to what many understood as the either the totalitarian directions in the social state, that's obviously Hayek's argument, or the redistributive effects that capitalists so opposed. What was set in motion as a response to those concerns turned into its own nightmare. And earlier iterations of the book I actually titled Neoliberalism's Frankenstein or Nightmare and so forth to try to get at the extent to which this is a project that's gone horribly awry. But it is true that while there is certainly, there are dimensions of the present that are mind-bogglingly new. And I say it that way because I think it's really important for us all to be somewhat humble intellectually and politically in the face of the eruptions in this world today that we still don't fully understand. And I don't pretend to explain them thoroughly. I don't spend much time on the evangelicals. I don't spend much time on social media and technology. I don't spend much time. I mean, I acknowledge all these things as among the forces that need to be understood as intensifying or building or responding to the anti-democratic forces of neoliberalism that I'm suggesting are governing our world. But I don't, the book is not dedicated to examining those things. And many fine works have been written on those issues. We need them all. Nobody has the whole story.
Yeah, great. So let's jump into the first several chapters of the book. As I understood them, the first three chapters were mainly concerned with neoliberal theory and its pernicious effects. You talk, as you mentioned, you talk a good deal about Hayek and about Milton Friedman and the Ordo Liberals. Chapter one discusses the critique of society, on the neoliberal view that society or some notion of the people as a substantive entity is something like a fiction, that is not something real. And this has implications for their challenge of, for instance, notion of social justice, which Hayek famously critiqued as a kind of fantasy. So maybe you could say a little bit about Hayek's views, maybe in particular, since they're maybe the most well known to political theorists, and how you see these as having certain kinds of effects, and what's your assessment of them?
So Margaret Thatcher famously did two things in the early part of her tenure as the leader of the UK. One was that she thumped on Hayek's Constitution of Liberty, declaring, "This is our Bible." And another is that she famously declared that there is no such thing as society, only individual women and men and their families. And often she's understood as referring in both cases to a case for deregulation and dismantling the social state. What I do in the chapter on the social, entitled Society Must Be Dismantled, is explore especially Hayek's, but also some of the other neoliberals' views, that society is, as Thatcher told us, non-existent. There is no such thing. There are only individual units and the state. And this was their shot over the bow to declare that both the principle of the social state and social democracy and the actual enacting of social democracy was wrongheaded. It was social engineering. It was the misbegotten idea that there was such a thing as a combined social good, or what some of us call the public good or the public interest, basically the stuff that has been at the center of political theory in the West for a couple thousand years. And instead, that there should only be individual entrepreneurship and a state to protect or sustain it by a proper order of law, especially centered in property rights. And the implications of this attack on the social are very deep, because as you say, it's at the heart of their attack on the notion of social justice, by which they primarily meant redistribution, but which today has become a larger mantra on the right as the wrongheaded totalitarian impulses of the left. So the right uses the language that Hayek used of social justice warriors to impose the ideas of the few on the many, and uses a Hayekian notion of liberty as well as traditional morality to push back against it. So social justice becomes not just misguided or something one may oppose with the idea of freedom, it also becomes that which inappropriately replaces traditional morality with social engineering, in gender, in race, in organizations of neighborhoods or of associations. Social justice is decried by neoliberals and, I would say, the hard right alike, as inappropriate interference in markets, but again, also in morality. So that's the heart of that chapter. It's an exploration of all the ways in which that has, that notion unfurled early on in the neoliberal revolution in the West, has come to take deep hold in the present as the arguments or the positions. It's come to take deep hold in the West in arguments that not only are agendas, so-called, of queer theory or trans inclusion and racial inclusion and all of those things wrong, but they're wrong at the level of being interferences in the natural moral and economic order of things. And that's a very serious ontological position. It can't be treated as mere ideological weaponry. That is what has been bequeathed to us by neoliberalism, and not just hard right, religiously motivated Christian morality.
One of the things I was wondering when reading this chapter was, I guess in thinking about Hayek, and I'm sure there are different interpretations of Hayek on this point, but I mean, I suppose one way to read the critique of the social, or one can say, I guess, the notion of the people as well, is that, I mean, these notions are very vague, and different people have different conceptions of the social or the people, the people's will, and so forth, different conceptions of social justice. And maybe it's best when it comes to the coercive power of government to simply just bracket our differences when it comes to those disagreements. And we can still conduct disagreements about, I guess, what anyone would want to call social justice, but we just wouldn't extend the coercive power of the state against it, right? You could have boycotts, or we could have this or that. I mean, maybe that's a kind of retreat to, you know, a sharp distinction between legality and morality that I guess probably is not maintained in the subsequent uptake of neoliberals. But I don't know if you had, you know, that kind of sense of the contentiousness of morality versus, like, you know, the sort of the stringency of legal norms.
I'm not sure I understand, so let me ask this question.
Yeah.
Are you saying that maybe the ideal is to leave the question of social justice out of political and legal intervention and let it operate at the level of personal predilection and social movements?
Yes.
So you would say all the ways in which civil rights and other legal means to redress the historical exclusions and subordinations at the site of gender or race were inept. They shouldn't have happened.
Well, yeah, so first of all, I certainly wouldn't say that, but
what I'm arguing in that first chapter is that if you attack the social as non-existent and say there are only individuals and valorize liberty and valorize traditional morality and valorize markets, you are without question consecrating the historical order of things that is built on particular kinds of exclusions and occlusions that has baked into it the histories of race and gender and other vectors of power that now have been eliminated as relevant to redress or transformation at the site of politics. And of course, above all, what you have done is argue that class is not an appropriate subject for political address. So if you want to make that argument, that's what you're doing. And that's exactly what the neoliberals were doing. Hayek was very, very clear about it. He knew exactly what he was trying to do. He was trying to move what he understood to be the claims erupting about society, the nature of society, the stratifications in society, the inequalities in society, the injuries in society, off of the political agenda, and instead make the state simply responsible for subtending markets and traditional morality and leaving individuals to do as they will. Now, if that's your politics, that's your politics. But I think to say, well, you know, social justice, it's a protean notion and it can go this way and that way. And so maybe we just ought to leave it to boycotts and personal values or personal approaches is to reiterate exactly that position. I'm suggesting, Jeff, that in a way you're offering a variation within the neoliberal rationality that I'm saying governs us. Liberty, we know. Inequality, social justice, that's too hard to get specified, so we should just move it out of the picture. It shouldn't be a matter for the state. It shouldn't be a matter for politics.
Yeah.
And that's what, you know, that has become mainstream. That has become legitimate in a way that even the conservative parties of the pre-neoliberal era did not make it mainstream. And it's not just about libertarianism. It's about a comprehensive account of the social, the moral, the political, the personal, the familial, and the traditional. That's why I think that's why I don't spend a lot of time, you know, arguing with libertarians. That's a one note thing over there. I'm more interested in the larger picture of what is governing our thought and constraining it and marking off what is thinkable or legible and what is not.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, it's very helpful because I mean, in a way, I envision your project as something of a kind of two stage process. That is, you're reading and critiquing particular theorists, but also the second stage is seeing how their own views are, I mean, it seems to me intensified. As you say, Hayek would never condemn or condone a lot of these things. And so the sort of the widespread extension of a lot of this thought.
Well, it's not so much extension. It's that turns, there are parts of his thinking, I try to make very clear that you know, his condemnation of the social and the political couldn't successfully kill it off. So what you get is a form of governing rationality that occludes the political beyond what states ought to do to manage markets and morals, and a concept of the social that is purely negative. And so what you have is that governing rationality, and then what you get are all kinds of eruptions and formations in the space that the rationality itself can't completely comprehend or control. And that's what I'm suggesting has happened in there. Neoliberal economists know that's what's happened in the market world, you know, where instead of getting perfect competition, they got, and instead of eliminating, instead of moving politics out of markets, radically separating politics from markets, what you got was their hyperfusion. So, you know, part of this is to say it's not that neoliberalism got extended beyond what the neoliberals hoped for. It's that what I'm offering is a reading of the failure and the limitations of neoliberal thought insofar as it was instantiated. And another way of putting it is, just as I do not want to completely take Marxism off the hook for some of the monstrosities of the 20th century under the sign of state communism or Marxism, I'm not taking neoliberalism off the hook for the monstrosity of the present. It's precisely that we need to read not just, oh, what went wrong with the plan, but what was wrong with the conceptualization. And in the case of both Marxism and neoliberalism, I'm arguing that in part, what was wrong was an incredibly thin notion of politics and the political, an incredible failure to understand the way that political power would perdure despite the attempt of both schools to try to contain and eliminate it or imagine that it could be subsumed to economics. So I want to be clear here. The reason I'm hammering this point is that I'm not trying to say, oh, you know, this isn't real neoliberalism. The neoliberals can go back to their real neoliberalism because that's not really what we got here. We got a production that is very much an expression of neoliberalism. It's just not the one that the neoliberals had hoped for or counted on.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, that last point was very helpful because I was also thinking of, you know, other, you could say, neoliberal thinkers of the present age. People like at the Niskanen Center, it's a kind of center-right organization. A guy named Will Wilkinson is there. And he, you know, I mean, it's interesting. I take it what he's trying to do, and this would be, I think, a break with the thing that you're describing, which is he's trying to bring something like the common good back in by saying, look, libertarians need to, well, they can hold on to the critique of regulatory policy, but they need to have a robust welfare state for the people who fall through an unfettered market. And so that in a way sort of, you know, is a break with that neoliberal tradition and in having a kind of strong view of the common good. So I'm seeing your point now. I mean, the sort of abstraction from a notion of the common good, a notion of the people, a notion of the social that even so like libertarian like Will Wilkinson can't continue in that vein. Because I wanted to ask about the politics chapter too. On chapter two, on politics must be dethroned, that neoliberals tend to be strongly antagonistic to politics. I guess maybe there's a similar question here. And again, this I think is betrays maybe some of my interest in some thinkers that maybe reacted against this tradition. But I wonder if a way to think about the neoliberal critique of politics is a critique of national politics, that something like a retreat to some kind of localism is more what they had in mind, those little platoons in a kind of Burkean tradition, that they certainly wanted to move away from national level politics, but maybe the local level politics would be more acceptable to them.
Well, Quinn Slobodian, in his wonderful book, The Globalists, argues quite the opposite, that what they were interested in was a global order and containing, certainly containing national politics or national sovereignty in the name of building a globally competitive order. So I think, you know, I don't know if you're speculating or if you have a particular neoliberal thinker in mind, but I think what we need to understand about the actual unfolding of the neoliberal revolution, or what we often call actually existing neoliberalism, is that globalization was part of it, and globalization meant delimiting political sovereignty at the national level to domestic non-economic concerns. At the same time, I want to complicate somebody like Slobodian's analysis by saying what you see in the concern in Hayek and the ordo-liberals with bulking up traditional morality, the family, and so forth. And you see that act concretely unfolded in the remaking of the welfare state in England and in the United States in the 80s and then in France and so forth. What you see is heavy reliance on the state for both organizing markets and, of course, bailing them out when necessary, when they're too big to fail, or when the state's so imbricated with them that it has no alternative, as was the case in the finance crisis. But also with bulking up the powers of church, family, traditional morality, and so forth. So let's be clear about what Hayek meant when he said politics must be dethroned. That's a direct quote from him. What he meant was that democracy must be understood purely as elections and the protection of rights. And political life must not be understood as legislating in the public interest, or even as legislating beyond simply sustaining the health of markets and the traditional moral order. And he was explicit, especially in the Constitution of Liberty, about identifying the limitations on politics and the constraints on politics with the remaking of a world in its proper fashion, where markets and morals would prevail and where freedom would be secured. So what did that entail concretely? It entailed separating democracy from the notion of popular sovereignty. He called popular sovereignty a nonsense notion, just like he called society a nonsense notion. It had no meaning, and it certainly ought not to be what we understood democracy to comprise. Instead, democracy was needed for a peaceful transition of power and for, as I said before, a certain modest legitimacy in producing states that subtended markets and morals. But in doing so, he often also understood that authoritarian moments would be needed. And he understood that you couldn't have democracy mean accountability to the people, let alone could it mean popular participation. So what you get with the neoliberal revolution is a full-throated assault on what remains of the notions of democracy from the 20th century that have to do either with social democracy or small r republican democracy, or democracy that in any way is understood to be about the people themselves controlling their lives or legislating in the interest of the common. And that's what he considered to be the most dangerous, as did the ordos. So what you get in across the variations and varieties of neoliberalism are arguments about how to contain and constrain and literally throttle democracy by removing it from legislative power, by making the legislative dimension, something that itself is constrained by what the Ordo has made explicit, a constitution that would protect markets, competitive markets, from state intervention and protect the realm of morality from social justice or social engineering efforts. So that's where you get the real frontal assault on democracy. And that's very different than saying, oh, they wanted to kind of preserve, you know, local control, but not at the national level and so forth.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thing I'll say is, of course, the robust ethno-nationalist, authoritarian nationalist, isolationist nationalist thing that's going on right now is one of those nightmares that are not parallel with the neoliberal dream. But I'm also suggesting they're born out of it because they have all those elements of property, family, traditional morality, and so forth. They're just trying to secure it through an ethno dimension.
I wanted to connect this, the dethroning of politics, up with the next chapter on morality, because I take it Hayek's claim in his view about moral traditionalism and the dethroning of politics is sort of a piece with his famous view about command economies and the way in which the money is the best way to understand a complex economy, because you have an extraordinarily complicated organism, really, that is the economy. And any attempt to sort of control it ends up leading to bad unintended consequences. And I take it this something similar is going on with his view of politics and morality, that you have an extremely complicated system. Many different people have many different moral values. And so any attempt to
that's not his concern. It's not about the many people with many moral values. That would be a nice liberal, multicultural, you know, pluralist view. His view is that traditional morality is all that has ever secured order in humanity, that it's not done by markets alone. Markets weave us together through cooperation without command. But you don't get a homogeneous, organized reproduction of the order from that alone. You have to have this other thing. And that's what he thinks the enormous force of traditional morality is. Not a bunch of different moral views, but what he calls refers to as the common principles of a community about who they are and what they do. And you take that and extend it to the present, and what you get is arguments about, you know, this is who we are as white people or as Christians, or as you name it, in terms of how it's named at the level of traditional morality. And no state, no law is going to intervene, not to produce gender equality, reproductive rights, gay rights, racial equality, or anything else. So that is at the heart of Hayek's argument, but also the ordo liberals. They were very strong on this. And so also in his own way was Milton Friedman. He really understood that you couldn't have this free market world without the traditional family holding it down, without a traditional order keeping it together. He was just less explicit about it than Hayek or the ordo liberals were. So you combine this view of traditional morality with the purpose of the state, which is to protect it along with markets, and you get, not surprisingly, out of those Supreme Court justices who are, among other things, trained in the Chicago law and economics world, extending the rights of traditional morality into the public sphere to push back against social justice schemes of the 20th century. And that takes us to the fourth chapter. Explicitly about law cases that are increasingly protecting the rights of individuals in the civic or commercial or public sphere to refuse laws that aim to protect those who are most vulnerable, whether it's the rights of those seeking reproductive freedom, that is women in hospitals seeking abortions or IUDs or other forms of birth control, or whether it's people in LGBT communities seeking to employ the services of people to have their unions consecrated as marriage or celebrated with cakes. And so I explore several cases in which the Supreme Court has gone out of its way to protect the rights of the traditional moralists against law that has been established, not in the name of social justice, though I would argue that that's what animates it, but in the name of equal rights. So what you get now is the liberty of traditional morality pushing back against the equality secured by the state. And case after case comes before the Supreme Court to test this. And I look at two. I look at one that's the famous wedding cake example from Colorado, the baker who doesn't want to make a cake for a same-sex couple. And then I also look at the imposition, the Supreme Court's reversal of the imposition on so-called pregnancy crisis centers of the requirement that they post in their centers the fact that they are not actually reproductive freedom providers, put it another way, that they don't offer a full panoply of services, and that that they are not medical establishments. And so I look closely at both cases. We don't have room to examine both of them here, but just to see how they exemplify the extent to which increasingly traditional morality, with its hierarchies and its exclusions, is being accepted by the court as a legitimate pushback against equal rights.
Yeah, I wonder what you think about the conservative view that you hear occasionally about that the conservatives have lost the culture war, as it were, and so they have to retreat to the free exercise clause of the First Amendment in order to carve out a space for themselves. At the point to, you know, polls about increasing leftward shift in Americans' understandings of social issues and so forth. And so, in other words, the culture war is lost, and the Christian view is on the defensive, as it were. Do you think the Christian view is on the defensive here? I get the sense from the chapter that you don't think so.
Oh, I think that it had to regroup and develop different strategies, without question. I mean, the pithy version of the argument that you're rehearsing here is that after gay marriage, the Christian right had to accept that that was a done deal after gay marriage was legalized across the land, and instead find other ways and other venues and spaces to continue the war. And that involved developing arguments, not just at the level of free exercise, but more broadly, free speech and conscience, to empower individuals, institutions, corporations, remember Hobby Lobby, and other entities to push back in the so-called non-existent social space against the requirements that they comply. So the culture wars are taken to a different point. So I don't, you know, they didn't lose the culture wars. They lost some of the legal battles. The culture wars are, if we want to call them that, still very much, you know, I mean, they're animating the present. That's the world we inhabit with the world that, you know, brought us the 2016 election. But I do think that, you know, part of what I'm trying to trace in that fourth chapter is the compliance of the Supreme Court majority not just with a traditionalist or religious or conservative, as it's often called, or rightward tilt, but a specific understanding of liberty, a neoliberal understanding of liberty as comprising more than economic liberalism and comprising a solid right against equality. And, you know, that's at the heart of the neoliberal project.
So the last chapter is on neoliberalism and nihilism, and your account of nihilism I found to be quite interesting, because you're sort of starting with a kind of Nietzschean concept of nihilism, but building on it, seeing that there's much more at stake here. So I thought maybe you could start by talking a little bit about what you mean by nihilism in this chapter and where you see it manifest in the wake of neoliberalism.
The most important thing, I'm actually working on a new project that is about nothing but nihilism.
Ah, great.
except I'm Weber is at the heart of it, because I think he's one of our more profound anti-nihilist thinkers or post-nihilist thinkers who's attempting to work through it in some way. But let's stay with the book that you have before you. The most important thing in the way I'm treating nihilism is to understand it not as an attitude or something that you find in culture and certain kinds of music or art or something like that, but a condition. And I take this not just from Nietzsche, but also Tolstoy, Dostoevsky, Weber, others, who really understood that once you have, that nihilism is baked into the Enlightenment, really. It doesn't manifest immediately, but, you know, that once you've toppled the foundations of truth in religion with science or enlightenment or what Weber calls disenchantment or desacralization, that what you get is an increasing, not just confusion about value and not just elimination of value, but a transformation of it in which values stick around, but they're increasingly, as it were, trivialized and instrumentalized and deployed for all kinds of things without having their roots deep in the ground. And they're quite fungible. We know all this. You know, Trump is a beautiful example of it, not only in the shifting qualities of his values, but in the way that he deploys values for his own opportunistic political interests. We know he's not religious. We know he doesn't believe in God, but he waves the flag of all of that. We know that he shifted his position on abortion and could really care less about abortion and so forth, but, you know, he knows where his base is. So what I'm interested in this chapter is the way that what Nietzsche called the 200-year period of unfolding nihilism, that he predicted at the end of the 19th century, the ways in which neoliberalism both put it on steroids, especially through economization and marketization of everything, but also the way in which the contemporary predicament we find ourselves in is shaped not just by the neoliberal assault on democracy, the political, the social, and so forth, but also is bound up with nihilism, with its desublimations, its lightening of conscience, its unleashing of a kind of raw will to power and raw aggressions into the public and civic sphere. Why does it do all of that? Because when values are depreciated, when they are themselves devalued, as Nietzsche put it, when they are lightened in their force and become trivial and fungible, when they're not emanating from a deep space and not saturating the culture as a whole, when they're bandied about, they lose their force in producing conscience itself. And conscience, as we know from Freud, from Nietzsche, and from others, is itself produced by a certain kind of repression or sublimation of energies And once these are desublimated, they come back into the culture with all kinds of ugliness and passion. And of course, that's what we're seeing today, whether it's trolling on the internet, whether it's rampaging and shooting, whether it's the incredible ugliness in contemporary politics and political battling, not just at the high levels, but the low ones, and the kind of celebration of this ugliness and desublimation and aggression. So the last chapter is trying to get at the ways in which the attacks on what I'm calling democracy by neoliberalism have melded with these nihilistic energies to produce the world that we're all witnessing in a daily and cringing way, politically, socially, culturally. So that last chapter is in some ways the beginning, as I said, of a next book, but it's also important to this one because it helps me explain, again, parts of how the neoliberal project ran off the rails, and in some ways that it could not have been predicted, even by critics of neoliberalism in an early period.
Yeah, I was thinking in this context about Irving Kristol has this essay called Capitalism, Socialism, and Nihilism. I think it's from the 70s. But, you know, there's something of a similar analysis there, if I recall it correctly, that he's critical of a, you know, sort of libertarian or neoliberalism wasn't there back then, but a sort of libertarian bent that unleashes the passions. He allied it to also the rise in the new left and the movements in the 1960s and the kinds of social revolutions that were going on then that also sort of unleashed things. And I wonder if you know, what you think of Kristol's analysis. I mean, he was also a critic of neoliberalism back then. And, you know, what you think about is if there's any responsibility that the left holds in all of this as well.
Kristol's always been interesting to me because as the so-called godfather of neoconservatism, he understood that, as he put it, capitalism gets two cheers. Mm-hmm. Is it for liberty and producing wealth? He didn't quite put it that way. But he withholds the third because it cannot deliver moral meaning or social integration. He didn't put it that way either. But he was alert early on to the extent to which you could not build a conservative social movement, a conservative political movement, on free market capitalism alone. Now, I've been arguing that that's never what neoliberalism was about, but that's certainly how it was popularized in the United States in the 70s. So when Irving Kristol is responding to it, he's responding to free marketeers versus social democrats, and he's warning the free marketeers, whom he wants to have as his allies, that they better conjoin that project with a neoconservative project that emphasized what? A strong state, authority, social morality, family, and the rest of it. So for him, the nihilism that he takes capitalism to generate is more about that conventional understanding of nihilism in which it just destroys meaning and destroys morality and destroys individual restraint or constraint. I'm trying to get at a slightly deeper understanding of where nihilism comes from that is not, yes, capitalism certainly intensifies it, but it's not just generated by that, and a slightly deeper understanding of its effects. That's why I'm using the language of desublimation rather than just license or liberty. So that means I'm not looking, for example, at the social movements of the 60s or the world of liberation movements and free love and the rest of it as mere expressions of nihilism because it's about license. I think that, you know, it's not that I have nothing to say to that argument, but my argument's a little different. Now, your question was, is the left responsible for what, a nihilistic condition today?
Well, part of, yeah, I mean, I take it part of
Chris. Is it making a contribution?
Yes, yes. Do you see any role of the left and the sort of revolutions in social life? What role do you see that as playing in any of this?
Depends on what the this is. Concludes your sentence.
Trump, for instance, is sometimes people say, you know, Trump is, this is, if it weren't for the sexual revolution, Trump wouldn't have been here. That's a provocative example for you.
There's a lot of ways that we wouldn't have him. So, look, this is a different book. This is a different story. But my argument is not to say it's the right's fault, it's the left's fault. Mm. I'm trying to diagnose conditions. I'm trying to do an anatomy of the conditions that produce both left and right. I have never in this book or any other book argued that neoliberals are always on the right. What I'm interested, though, I mean, they're not. Clinton was, you know, Clinton and Obama were at the center of completing the neoliberal revolution in this country. And I make that very clear in both books. But I also am trying to say about the conditions that we're in, that neoliberalism has generated the hard right turn of the present without saying that it is an explicitly neoliberal turn. That's what this book is trying to argue. It's not saying the right is at fault for all the bad things in the world. It's saying rather that one of the contributions to our current predicament, which is a very serious predicament, one that has the danger of the existential crisis of the planet as well as the existential crisis of democracy at stake, that one of the important contributions to bringing us to this pass was the neoliberal transformations, rationality, forms of reason, forms of subject production, not forms of anti-citizenry and anti-democracy that have unfurled over the last 40 years. That is not a left-right thing, but one of the things we're having right now is a hard right set of effects from it. And I could write another book on where you can see the particular formation of the left out of this form of rationality, but that's not, to me, the extreme danger in the planetary sphere. It may be ineffective. I have plenty of complaints about it. But what's scary to me, and I think should be scary to most thinking people, is the precipice that we're on. And that's the effect of a right turn. And that right turn in turn, I am claiming, is among other things, the effect of the unfolding of neoliberal reason. That was a completely contingent unfolding. Didn't have to happen. There were a lot of forces making it happen. That's another whole story. But, that's the accident of the second or the last third of the 20th century.
Final question, Wendy, if I may.
Sure.
Do you have hope for the future? Or is there, where do we go from here? Is there a path that you see out of this predicament? And if so, what is it?
I'm a dark thinker. I don't have, I never have had a lot of hope for our future, not since I started thinking about our future, which was when I was very young. But I do believe that what you have to do in this world, as long as you're living in it and on it, is make hope. And there are many, many people trying to do that in all kinds of ways. There are people struggling to stop, the clear cutting of rainforests in Latin America. There are people struggling with democratic and other kinds of anti-neoliberal and anti-fascist experiments in politics and in production. There are certainly figures like Ocasio-Cortez, who make electoral politics still seem like a place where it is possible to articulate deep, humane, intelligent values and reforms built on them. There are communities that are fighting for their survival, but also at the same time trying to fight for the survival of their planet and making an effort to balance both. So there's lots of effort on the part of this, in quarters of this species of ours. There's also not a lot of time left for the planet, as we know that, And at the same time, there are a lot of really, really big, unprecedentedly powerful forces organizing possibility. And those include, for example, the power of finance, which nobody controls. It's global. It's spectacular in its ability to move nations and peoples and production sites and much more, but spectacular in its utter uselessness to the species on this planet, if you actually think about it from any kind of distance. But it's not going to go back in the bottle. So on the one hand, I see lots of sites in which people are trying to generate alternatives and hope. And on the other hand, I see formidable powers and obstacles, not just those of the particularly dark political present. So I guess that's the answer.
We have a challenge
ahead
of us.
As long as we're on this planet, I think, to earn a place on it, do what we can to try to generate alternatives to this present. Will we succeed? I'm not very confident.
Well, Wendy, it's a good place to finish. So let me say thank you once again for this wonderful conversation on the Political Theory Review.
Thank you. Bye, Jeff.
You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. Thanks to the Starting Points Journal for partnering with us. And thanks to you for listening.